and welcome to Polylogue, a weekly dialogue on the substance and style of the Sunday morning political shows, where we take a critical look at the policymaker, the politician, and the journalist, because each is critical and each demands criticism. I'm Brendan Stiles Soto, your co-host and communications specialist in government, technology, and healthcare.
And I'm Naomi Soto Seidel, your other co-host and health policy professional based in California. Before we start the show, just want to do a quick reminder. If you like the show, we'd love it if you could share it with your family and friends, either online and in person. Word of mouth is the most common way that podcasts are shared among friends and family. And if you like the show, you can also rate us on iTunes or the Apple Podcast. Again, it really helps new people find the show.
Yep, just a few stars. So on the agenda today, there's the Michael Cohen, the recent investigation into him, the seizing of those files by the FBI that raided his offices. And there's kind of this very interesting conversation that took place on this week. And it was about the investigation and what that means. And it was with Alan Dershowitz and legal commentators. But we also have to talk this week about this absolutely bananas interview with Kellyanne Conway on State of the Union.
Yeah, so this was an interview that happened with Dana Bash, who was filling in for Jake Tapper. And I don't think either one of those ladies was anticipating the interview that happened. It went from weird to hostile, back to weird again, and we have to talk about it. The other thing we want to let you know that we're not talking about today, but happened on the Sunday morning talk shows, was this really important conversation that was on the panel on This Week, and that was specifically about how the press covered the 2016 election and what we're learning and applying or not applying for the 2018 midterms. Just for the sake of time, we're going to hold that conversation and have a special episode just on this exact issue. It's kind of part of the inspiration for Polylogue in general, but we just kind of want to make that note that there's a much broader conversation coming.
Absolutely. But first, as always, highlight lowlight, starting low, going high. Naomi, what's the lowlight this week?
So you kind of quickly hinted at it. It was the introduction to the legal panel on This Week. Let's take a listen how George Stephanopoulos opens it up.
Flip, want to dig into it with our panel of legal experts. Alan Dershowitz, Professor Emeritus at Harvard Law School, author of Trumped Up, How Criminalization of Political Differences Endangers Democracy. Our Chief Legal Analyst, Dan Abrams. And Mimi Rokoff, former federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, now criminal justice fellow at Pace Law School. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Professor Dershowitz, let me begin with you. The president clearly agitated by all this pressure on Michael Cohen. He also called the raid on Cohen an attack on our country. After those raids, how serious is the threat to Cohen and Trump?
So the problem here is that this introduction didn't recognize that Alan Dershowitz himself is tied up with Trump. He recently had dinner with Trump just a few weeks ago and has become a very high-profile defender of Donald Trump. He appears constantly on all sorts of cable news programs that the president watches and has become kind of a favorite of Trump himself. And yet none of this was divulged in the introduction to talk about these very issues on This Week. And that seemed very journalistically inappropriate.
Absolutely. And it just seemed, knowing that, you would have a better understanding of the conversation that was about to ensue or the perspective of each of those panelists. And it just seemed incredible that that was missing.
Absolutely.
Brendan, what's the highlight for this week?
So my highlight is a moment when Dana Bash is speaking with Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee. He's a Republican, and he's recently announced that he's not going to run for re-election. And there's a very interesting situation where obviously you have a Democrat and a Republican who are going to be running for his open Senate seat. And he's apparently, over the years, been quite friendly with the Democratic candidate. And so Dana Bash asks him about his endorsement.
Look, I've sent the maximum contribution to the Republican nominee on our side. I've said I'm going to plan to vote for this person. I was in a long meeting where I talked about they were asking me about Governor Bredesen. He is my friend. I'm not going to campaign against him, but I'm supporting our nominee.
Can you tell me why Republican Marsha Blackburn is better to represent your state in Tennessee and take your seat than Phil Bredesen?
Well, I think most people in our state, it is a red state, will focus on the first vote she makes, and that's the vote to elect the majority leader. And I think at the end of the day, that's going to be a big factor in the race. But, you know, Dana, the rest of the story wasn't written during the interview I had with the Christian Science Monitor. And
Senator, that's not a ringing endorsement of Marsha Blackburn to say that she should be elected just because she's going to vote for Mitch McConnell.
Well, Dana, you know, I'm supporting the nominee. I've worked with the nominee for some time, and I don't know what else to say.
Okay, we'll leave it there. The Senate Foreign Relations Chairman, Bob Corker, thank you so much for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
My goodness, that's so awkward.
Yeah, and Dana did a fantastic job. So that takes us to segment number one, where we're going to really dive deep into this fascinating panel that was held on this week. And that is with Alan Dershowitz, who's, again, we mentioned, been quite friendly with Trump. He is the professor emeritus at Harvard Law School. And he's the author of a book, this is what it's called, Trumped Up, How Criminalization of Political Difference Endangers Democracy. There was also chief legal analyst Dan Abrams. And we've seen him on the shows quite a
bit. Multiple times.
And also Mimi Rocha. She's the former federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, and she's now a criminal justice fellow at Pace Law School.
And the Southern District of New York is the same district that the Cohen investigation is now taking place in.
Right. So it was a very interesting group of people.
Top-notch in their fields.
To discuss this issue. So one of the first things that Dershowitz did is he started going after prosecutors, and he started making this case that the prosecutors in this instance were going after Michael Cohen simply to go after Trump, and that these were, perhaps in his words, trumped up charges in order to go after the president. But Rocha, Mimi Rocha, wasn't going to hear it. Because that's her job.
Oh, it's a very serious threat. This is an epic battle for the soul and the cooperation of Michael Cohen. And prosecutors have enormous weapons at their disposal. They can threaten him essentially with life imprisonment. They can threaten his parents. They can threaten his spouse. They have these enormous abilities to really put pressure and coerce a witness. On the other hand, the president has a unique weapon that no other criminal defendant or suspect ever has. He has the pardon power. And go back to Christmas 1992, when President Bush exercised that pardon power and pardoned Caspar Weinberger, precluding him from pointing the finger at him.
Put a lot on the table right there. We'll get to each of it in turn. But Mimi, I got to go to you first, because I saw you sort of squinting as Professor Dershowitz was talking about all those threats the prosecutors can make.
Yeah, I have a response to that. You know, look, that's not what prosecutors do in my experience, having been one for 16 and a half years and having, you know, worked with many of them across different districts, including New York. They do not threaten people's parents and children. I mean, I don't know what, it sounds good, but I don't know where that accusation is coming from.
You want some examples?
But if I could, what they do with cooperators is, especially a cooperator like Michael Cohen.
It seems almost here like Mimi Rocha is both insulted and dumbfounded by the accusation that prosecutors will just kind of go fishing for things, as opposed to saying if there are people in a suspect's orbit who have also conducted criminal activity or part of it in some way, then they're kind of fair game to also use as leverage, as opposed to just kind of like roping them in and kind of threatening the primary suspect to kind of acquiesce and just kind of admit to something.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of crazy. I was kind of scratching my head, like, what is Dershowitz trying to get at here? And it sounds like he's got a personal issue with prosecutors and the way they operate. Like, he feels like they are too, like, not the special counsel, not Mueller, but any prosecutor can just do anything, can trump up any charge they want. And it's some massive abuse of power, and he's basically calling into question anyone who's being investigated for anything. right? He's and he kind of makes this point, and I'm really, really glad that even though Dershowitz wasn't introduced the way he should have on this panel, I think that the This Week staff did a fantastic job of finding Mimi Rocha and putting her there to push back against him, because without that pushback, you might think that this is a reasonable position to have, but he basically ends up coming off as kind of a, you know, sky is falling sort of conspiracy theorist. Let's go ahead and play a little bit more of that pushback.
This stuff matters, and it doesn't matter whether he likes the president or doesn't like the president. What matters is the sword of Damocles hanging over his head. Michael Milken, they told him they were going to indict his brother unless he pleaded guilty. Jonathan Pollard, they told him they were going to indict his wife. I can go down case after case after case.
But that may
where
be because
prosecutors
they were
right, they have
involved in criminal activity.
Well, of course, that's the point.
But to say
the
that the government threatens people's relatives with
they,
no
I didn't
basis
say
about
no
their
basis.
Conduct.
I said they threaten relatives and then they create the basis. They wouldn't otherwise go after these people, but they hold these people hostage. That's what prosecutors do. Every defense attorney knows that. And to look in the camera and say that prosecutors don't threaten relatives is to mislead the American public. Sorry.
I disagree, obviously.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think This Week did a really good job of having the right balance on the panel. And Mimi Rocha is profoundly important in this conversation. She's not kind of disagreeing with Dershowitz point for point, but I think she is really adamant in saying what you're saying is not the assumed legal standpoint.
Yeah, and it was very fascinating because, you know, I turned to you after we viewed this, Naomi, and I was thinking, why is Alan Dershowitz on here? He doesn't necessarily represent what the vast majority of legal scholars think when it comes to the Michael Cohen situation and what the audience of viewers might expect in terms of how it's going to play out, how it's going to get resolved, what it's going to mean for the country. And yet he's on here representing this kind of fringe view of the whole situation. And how is that serving the viewer?
Yeah, so I think I would disagree that it's fringe. I think there's a lot of people who believe Dershowitz. There's Trump's whole base who has been listening to Dershowitz on conservative media. So I don't think it's like super fringy in that only kind of the people in the extremes. Like there's huge swaths of the country who assume this. And the motivation to have Dershowitz on a show like This Week is to say a lot of people are listening to him. Let's have his legal perspective on here and let's have someone who is his kind of equal weight to be able to counter what he's saying or to provide the opposite perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a little interesting, but from a viewer who hasn't been following the news quite as closely as we have, they wouldn't recognize Dershowitz as representing anyone on the right or the President Trump or any of that style of thinking. They would just view him as some professor from Harvard. You know, they just view him as an expert in his field rather than as a representative of a fringe view about this law situation.
Perhaps, but I feel like most people who are watching the Sunday morning political shows are interested in politics in some way. I would bet that there is a portion of, you know, political media enthusiasts who are actually relieved to see Dershowitz on the show, but not just to be assumed to have legal standing or kind of like that his perspective goes unchallenged. Like if I was someone who follows the political news really closely, I'm like, wow, finally a segment where Dershowitz is not quote unquote the legal expert and no one challenges him.
So you're saying the importance of this segment is to have Dershowitz on so he can be challenged.
Yes.
He's become such a personality in the media that it's important to invite him on to be challenged. And that's what this panel was sort of about, not just about having a bunch of legal experts talk about the news.
I think that's part of the motivation, at least.
Interesting. Well, he certainly was challenged. And in this clip in particular, he's having a discussion with Dan Abrams, who's the Chief Justice correspondent for ABC News. He, again, kind of comes off a bit as a conspiracy theorist.
So in this segment, we hear Dan Abrams respond to George Stephanopoulos' quote and comment that Michael Cohen has a high probability of getting indicted. The fact that the FBI raided his office means that there's probable cause, that they're like building a case, that the fact they got the subpoena means that they have already something on him. And so it's not up to chance that he's going to get indicted. It's a most likely.
Very high that he's going to be indicted. But we have to separate out the two. They got a warrant here not because there was information on Donald Trump that they wanted from Michael Cohen. They got the warrant because there was information on Michael Cohen potentially committing a crime.
And if you believe that, I have a bridge I can sell you in Brooklyn.
You're actually going to say that a judge signed off on a warrant?
Absolutely.
To get judges to sign off on warrants like Christmas presents.
Right, yes.
To get information on his client. They signed off on a warrant saying, we want information on his client, not on him.
There's no way in which they would go after Michael Cohen if they weren't interested in his client. They're interested in his client in two different ways.
Because
there's no way
he could have committed a crime by himself.
He might have, but
right?
they wouldn't have even looked at what he was doing if he weren't the president's lawyer. They're going after him for two reasons. One, to try to flip him, and two, to try to find information that would show that there's an exception to the lawyer-client privilege under the crime fraud. You know, if you're going to...
Who's the they, by the way?
The prosecutor.
Which prosecutor?
The Southern District of New York.
Oh, okay, so it's not Mueller's team now.
They're working together. If they weren't working together, then Sessions would be back on the case because he only recused himself from the Russia investigation. If these were separate investigations...
So there's no such thing as independent work on the part...
In this case.
And in the District of Columbia, when they're investigating McCabe, that too is going to be hand-in-hand?
Absolutely. Of course, they're all working close together to try to target the president or people close to him.
I wanted to get to that.
Hold on a second.
Yeah, this is really important because what we hear Dershowitz saying is, they're working together, and then they're working together, and they're all in cahoots, and they're all working together, and they're all just trying to take down the president.
And if this was on, for instance... Sean Hannity show, that would be the conversation that they're having.
Yeah, Dershowitz would be the only one on.
Exactly.
And he'd be able to make his points without being challenged.
Exactly.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate Abrams pushing back because in Dershowitz's mind, in the view that he puts here, look at what he says. If you believe they got the warrant because there was information on Michael Cohen committing a crime, I have a bridge to sell you. What? That judges sign off on warrants like Christmas presents? No.
I'm sure Harvard does not appreciate its name tied to Dershowitz right now.
Yeah. And you know, it's only going to increase. I mean, you know that dinner with President Trump is going to turn into a lunch. And then another dinner. And then another dinner. And then a meeting.
Dershowitz's dinners.
Yeah, that Dershowitz is going to show up at the White House more and more until finally we read in the paper that... In addition to Rudy Giuliani, he's now got Alan Dershowitz on his side.
Well, that's kind of what's been buzzing around already, right?
Yeah.
But there was one point that Dershowitz made that made our ears perk up and learning something new and like, hadn't thought about that. And it was this idea of President Trump pardoning Michael Cohen, what that means and what some of those limits are.
So initially, this idea that Trump is going to pardon Cohen, you might think, he's going to pardon Cohen because he wants to help his friend, right? He just wants to help his friend. But of course, that's not the real reason. He's going to pardon Cohen so that he can help himself, right? So that all the charges that have to do with Cohen don't somehow trickle their way out into his investigation, right? And one thing that came up on this conversation is that this pardon by a president to sort of protect themselves from an independent prosecutor like Mueller has happened before. It happened by George H.W. Bush, not George W. Bush, but his father, George H.W. Bush. And it was related to a scandal that embroiled not Bush's administration, but Ronald Reagan's administration, where Bush was vice president. There was actually an independent prosecutor in that case who was investigating the fact that the Reagan White House had sold arms to Iran to help underwrite rebels in Nicaragua. It's a very, very complicated thing that was going on there. But that's what was being investigated. And George H.W. Bush decided to pardon six people. And listen to this. This is from a New York Times article published in 1992. It said, quote, the independent prosecutor, Lawrence E. Walsh, plans to review a 1986 campaign diary kept by Mr. Bush. Mr. Walsh has characterized the president's failure to turn over the diary until now as misconduct. But in a single stroke, Mr. Bush swept away one conviction, three guilty pleas, and two pending cases, virtually decapitating what was left of Mr. Walsh's effort, which began in 1986. Isn't that crazy?
Absolutely.
So this idea that a president might pardon someone in order to protect themselves...
There's precedent for it.
There's precedent for it. Exactly, yeah. But Dershowitz had an interesting point here that we hadn't heard before.
Look, there's another vulnerability in a pardon. You pardon somebody, he doesn't have a Fifth Amendment. So as soon as you pardon him, he doesn't need immunity. You call him as a witness, and he has to testify or else he goes to jail. Then the president has to pardon him for contempt, and it becomes very, very difficult for a president.
I hadn't really thought about that at all. The fact that if Cohen is pardoned, he can't plead the Fifth anymore.
Right, because he's not incriminating himself because he's been given a pardon. So he's not, there's nothing to, there's no crime that he's talking about regarding himself. So that's a very, very fascinating, fascinating piece of information.
I kind of still don't buy it. Like, I kind of want someone other than Dershowitz to be like, yes, that is interesting, but we don't have that. So I guess more to come on that.
Yeah, it was a fascinating conversation into areas of this crazy legal universe that we're all being sucked into with some experts who were kind of fiery.
It reminds me of, did you see that tweet a couple weeks ago where someone, I can't remember, it was like some reporter, and they were just like, I had no idea lawyers had such interesting jobs, because they just assume they're like, you know, doing boring contracts or whatever, but there's a lot of juicy infighting or potential raids, and you know, just kind of everything around this just makes the legal profession seem a lot more nuanced.
Well, yeah, and the legal profession, particularly when it comes to the conduct of the president, because so much of the legal realm is defined by past precedent, past things that have happened. And with a country of over 300 million people that's been around for well over 200 years, there's a lot of different iterations of things that have happened in the law with all those different people through all those different relationships and businesses and goings on for all that time. But when it comes to the presidency, there haven't been a lot of presidents. Trump is only number, what, 45?
45.
So there's all sorts of things that have never really come to pass that we don't really know what's going to happen. And this is kind of one of those instances where the whole legal profession is like, I don't know. Well, there's not a lot to look back on.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So that takes us to our second segment, which we wanted to spend, you know, a significant amount of time on because, well, this was one of our last interviews that we heard. We listened to State of the Union last, and we just finished this segment, like, what just happened?
It was out of control, and it went on for so long. I couldn't believe how long it went on. It was just like, you know when you're sitting at a restaurant outside for lunch, and you hear some people at the table kind of like next to you or behind you, and, you know, they're kind of, I don't know, there's some fire in their conversation, they're maybe not getting along. They don't sound like they're getting along. And you're like, whatever, you know, we'll continue our meal. And then they just start like arguing. And you're like, oh my God, listen to this. And then it just goes on and on and on. And you keep expecting someone to like step away from the table or just say, okay, you're right. Or I can't stand it. Or I've had enough of you. But no, this just kept going.
Yeah. Super fascinating conversation. So this was, again, with Dana Bash on State of the Union, who was filling in for Jake Tapper, and Kellyanne Conway was on the show.
The longtime Trump spokesperson.
Yeah, senior advisor, former campaign manager, close to the president in many issues.
Now, the first thing I think it's worth mentioning here is, yes, this interview went off the rails quite a bit, like wildly.
It went off the rails and then it just went like spinning in the air.
For a long, long time.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, you know, and here's the thing. Dana Bash, we think, is one of the weakest hosts to host a show.
A Sunday morning talk show.
And we've mentioned it before in the past. But that doesn't mean that she can't do a good job or she can't get some interesting information out there. And I felt in the first half of this interview, I was thinking, boy, we're going to highlight this. Like, Dana Bash is surprising. She's doing a pretty good job of holding Kellyanne's feet to the fire, which is so hard to do. She's so slippery. Even George Stephanopoulos has trouble with her sometimes, right?
You have a nicer impression of Dana Bash, and I think that's going to be part of this conversation.
But keep going. Yeah. Here's a part where I felt like Dana Bash seemed to do a pretty good job at pushing back when Kellyanne made a ridiculous claim.
Okay, so you just heard me mention that tweet, the president talking about Michael Cohen, saying people will flip if the government lets them out of trouble. He thinks Cohen won't do that. Why is the president, though, talking about the notion of Michael Cohen flipping if the president didn't do anything wrong?
You have to look at everything the president has said about Michael Cohen and the FBI raid. He's defending someone who he's worked with and known for a dozen plus years, Dana, who he thinks is being treated unfairly. Look at what happened this week, a tale of two tales, if you will. You've got Jim Comey on the one hand going out on a big book tour after saying, I don't leak, I'm not sneaky, I don't make any weasel moves, and doing all of the above again and again, including in his memos. I mean, look at the DNC server. The FBI didn't bother to secure or search the DNC's server when the DNC had been hacked. And here, Michael Cohen is subject to a raid by the same organization.
Okay, let me get back to the original question, though, which is, at its core, what does the president have to hide that he is worried that Michael Cohen will flip over? Meaning, what information does he have to give?
That wasn't your original question, Dana, respectfully. And that isn't what he's saying in these tweets. In these tweets, he's saying this is a fine family man who he worked with for many years. He thinks he's being treated unfairly.
Well, my initial question was, what does he have to hide if the president didn't do anything wrong? My question is, are you confident, just trying to get at the same answer, the same notion, and see if you can tell me if the president did unequivocally nothing wrong that he is worried that Michael Cohen will tell the feds about?
Dana, the president is, you're asking me, what do I know is in documents over a dozen or so years? I'm telling you that the president's concern has been for Michael Cohen and the way he's been treated.
So there's Kellyanne saying, respectfully, that's not what you asked. And Dana Bash is saying, respectfully, you didn't answer my question. And now I'm going to ask it again, and you're going to have to give a really awkward answer. And so Dana Bash asks, can you say unequivocally that the president did nothing wrong and has nothing to worry about? And what is Conaway's answer? You're asking me, what do I know is in documents over a dozen or so years? I don't know what's in the documents. That's her answer.
Yeah, no, Kellyanne's answer is very weak here. I think what is important to highlight here, and the reason I am more hesitant to give Dana Bash the kind of credit that I think you want to give her right now, Brendan, is like the way she asks questions, like I don't understand. Like, let's break down multiple instances when she, at the start of these clips that we just highlighted, she says, why is the president, though, talking about the notion of Michael Cohen flipping if the president didn't do anything wrong? That is a very clunky question and an easy question to slip out of.
Yeah.
Like, and Kellyanne is so good at slipping out of these questions. Like, you cannot give her a question in that format because she will just pick like one part and be like, he didn't do anything wrong. But that's not what the question is implying. It's implying, why does he think Michael Cohen might flip? Right?
Right.
But because the question is phrased in such a cumbersome way, it gives Kellyanne like a rope to grab on and shake and distract. And
it's
she does
not direct
this
enough.
Yeah, and then she does it again later. In the other instance, so you're right. So Kellyanne says, gives some, you know, garbage answer. And then Dana Bash says, let me get back to the original question, though. All right, good. Good bringing it back. Like, good follow-up pivot point. But then she says, let's get back to the original question, though, which is, at its core, what does the president have to hide that he is worried that Michael Cohen will flip over? Meaning, what does he have? What information does he have to give? Are you like, what?
Yeah, that's confusing. That's extremely confusing.
Yeah, exactly.
And then she clarifies again and she says, well, my initial question was, what does he have to hide if the president didn't do anything wrong? And then she rephrases it again. My question is, are you confident, just trying to get at the same answer, the same notion, and see if you can tell me if the president did unequivocally nothing wrong that he is worried that Michael Cohen will tell the feds about?
Can we just get to there?
Yeah. Took her a long time.
It took Dana Bash a significantly long time. And with a guest like Kellyanne, you don't have her on the air that long. Well,
this time you do.
But I think that's like really part of my frustration with Dana Bash. Like, you can't approach a slippery guest in this way.
Or any guest, frankly.
That's true. But especially one like Kellyanne. Yes.
That said, there's something she did that Dana Bash did that I would really, really like more reporters to do when a White House spokesperson is on. And let's just play a bit of this. And this is Kellyanne Conway. You'll hear her voice first. And she is talking about who knows what. She's always talking about something. Here she goes.
Our best intro yet.
I see people go on TV constantly who don't know President Trump at all and say he's loyal to no one but himself. That is completely not true. He stands up for people in his inner circle and people he knows when he thinks they're being treated unfairly. And he's done it again and again. He shows a great sense of loyalty to people whom he thinks is being treated unfairly. But remember, too, this investigation of almost a year was supposed to be about Russian collusion. Look at all the screaming graphics CNN has invested in. Look at all the airtime and the ink spill on this.
But this is separate.
And now we're up into, well, yes, now we're up into different shoots and
ladders. But you said there are people on TV who don't know the president. You are on TV and you know the president quite well. You work for the president and you're here on his behalf and behalf of the White House.
I love that. You know, Conway wasn't answering clearly, and Bash just went back to her and said, hold on, you represent the president, you know the president, and now I'm going to ask you a question, so please answer it. And I wish people did that more. I wish reporters did that more when someone was representing the White House and tried to, in Kellyanne's words, weasel their way out of it. But, like you said, Naomi, here's the next line that came out of Dana Bash's mouth. Here's the question that she wanted to ask Kellyanne Conway.
Can you tell me that the president is, can you assure the American people that the reason the president isn't tweeting concern about Michael Cohen flipping because he is in potential legal jeopardy given whatever he knows that Michael Cohen has that the feds now have from that search?
What is that? Can you just replay that? Hold on.
Why don't you read it?
Okay. This is Dana Bash. Quote, can you tell me that the president is, can you assure the American people that the reason the president isn't tweeting concern about Michael Cohen flipping because he's in potential legal jeopardy, given whatever he knows that Michael Cohen has that the feds now have from that search?
What
end
is
quote.
That?
What end is quote. That? End quote forever. That literally doesn't make sense. Like, it's such a complicated question.
And Kellyanne Conway answers it, you know, she takes it in stride. Here's how she answers it.
Search. Dana, the president is talking about Michael Cohen here. The SDNY has jurisdiction over this. The Southern District of New York has jurisdiction over this case now. And the president has made very clear that he thinks this is an overwrought process.
There you go. Not bad. She's like, the president is talking about Michael Cohen here. I don't know what you're talking about, Annabeth. The president is talking about Michael Cohen.
Absolutely. And there's this point in the middle of the interview where you just kind of get a real sense that Kellyanne Conway and Dana Bash are just like, WTF, what is happening in this interview? This is like not what we expected. Let's hear this interesting transition moment.
But this affects but the American people.
But these are, I guess,
Dana, if
you're
the president
in a position,
didn't tweet, what would CNN talk about? I'm incredibly curious.
You know what?
Curious.
We would talk a lot more about the issues
but
that he's
wouldn't.
Not diverting from.
You would not, because
we
when
would.
He doesn't
and we,
tweet,
and we do.
You don't anyway.
And we do. But because he's tweeting a lot this weekend, I have to ask you about it, because you're here representing
him. I'm happy to answer.
it's so crazy. You go.
Yeah, they're clearly like not getting along, period. Like these are two people. If you heard these two people talking in that restaurant I mentioned earlier.
If this was the table behind you,
you'd be like, holy cow. These people do not like each other.
Yeah.
That's very clear. But one thing I do appreciate here, again, with what Dana Bash is doing, Kellyanne Conway likes to come on the shows. She's constantly asked about the president's stupid tweets. And she constantly says, hey, let's not be diverted by the important things that we're doing. The president
People care about the outcomes.
A historic tax cut. The president has made inroads with North Korea in a way that we've never seen before. The president has cut regulations so American businesses can get back to work. We need to talk about the important issues. And I'm so glad that Dana Bash is saying, okay, but this is not a distraction. This is your president who is distracting us with his tweets. So we are perfectly within our rights to ask you about them.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing, Dana Bash didn't explicitly say it quite as much, but this whole kind of back and forth about Trump's tweets, this was after Dana Bash asks Kellyanne about Trump's tweet about the drugged and drunk loser who's the source for, I think, that New York Times interview, and that Comey is both a liar and his memos vindicate him. Like, she's just like, Trump's tweets don't make sense. They're rude. Like, are they appropriate? Are they honest? Like, please answer them. Like, answer to them, because they, like, how are Americans supposed to respond to this?
And Kellyanne Conway can't even answer who the hell Trump is talking about, this drugged and drunk loser. She doesn't even know.
Yeah.
And Dana Bash is saying, you're being evasive, you're being evasive. And Conway just has to say, I don't know who that is. I don't know what the hell that tweet was about.
Yeah. But that's not even where it gets the most crazy.
We're just going to play it. Here it is.
We're almost out of time. I just want to ask you one question that a lot of people are asking me, probably you too. And that is, what is up with your husband's tweets? Your husband is a very well-respected lawyer, and he's been sending some tweets that have been critical of the administration. Just an example, in response to a tweet he saw saying President Trump's aides are reluctant to speak for him because he contradicts them later, your husband wrote, "So true, it's absurd."
He writes a lot of things that are also supportive, and he writes a lot of things about corgis and Philadelphia Eagles and sports, too. But the fact is, well, two things I'll say to you. Number one, that, again, that woman who lost the election, whose name I never see on TV anymore, is wrong. That women, I think she said white women, have to listen to their the men in their life to form their own political opinions. Wrong again, lady. Number two, it's fascinating to me that CNN would go there, but it's very good for the whole world to have just witnessed that it's now, that it's now fair game what people's, how people's spouses and significant others may differ with them. I'm really surprised, but some ways relieved and gratified to see that. That should really be fun.
No, I actually, first of all, I would ask you that if you were a man and your wife
wouldn't.
I would.
No.
And it's not about that. It's about questioning, publicly questioning what you are doing for a living and with regard to your boss. And it has nothing to do with your gender.
No, and it has nothing to do with my spouse.
Okay, some context. Kellyanne's husband is George Conway. And as Dana Bash mentioned, he is a well-respected lawyer. He's a lawyer with the New York City-based firm Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz. And he's a prominent Republican fundraiser and leader. He actually joined the legal team representing Paula Jones in the sexual harassment lawsuit against President Bill Clinton in the 90s. And he was up for two different positions in the Trump administration, which he didn't end up getting for a variety of reasons. And he's been very public in his frustration and confusion and annoyance with the Trump White House. It's not like some private spouse who's, you know, venting at Bridge Club or whatever. But you're well known, you're respected, and you're going on Twitter to complain about your wife's boss.
Yeah, but I really feel like Kellyanne Conway, in this clip that you just heard, was just floored that this would come up and that this would be asked on national television. But that's not where it ended. This wasn't it. This went on. You know, Bash introduces this as, remember, the first thing she said in this clip that you heard was, Kellyanne, we're almost out of time. I just have one more question to ask you. No. This was like the middle point of the interview. The rest of the interview was about this. Here's another little clip where things continue to devolve.
Okay. Well, that certainly was not intended to cross any Rubicon. It was actually intended to be somewhat lighthearted about the fact that we are all grown-ups who have different opinions, but I'm sorry that you took it.
You said, I've got to ask you a question that's on everybody's mind.
It is. It is. It is. I'm sure you hear it too. It is. And it is hard to have two adults in a situation like this, but it is unusual.
I'm sorry,
for,
what does that mean?
It is unusual.
I'm sorry, it's hard for whom? I'm sorry, back it up.
It is hard for
whom? Who are the two adults? My husband.
You
and
your husband. My point
now
is
you're
that,
talking about my marriage again?
I'm not talking about your marriage.
Yeah,
I'm Kellyanne.
Husband.
Kellyanne, here was my whole point in this.
It's hard for whom?
Is that you are a professional working for the President of the United States, and your husband is a very well-respected lawyer. And my point is that we don't often see, in fact, I don't remember the last time we saw somebody working for the president in a high-profile position when their spouse is saying critical things about them. It is not about gender. I don't want to have this conversation. You know that I don't believe that it's about gender.
No, it's not about gender. Hold on. It's not about gender. There's been a different standard for me than there have been for other people. And we bite our tongue plenty because I work for the people of this country, United States government, the presidency, and the president of the United States. So there's plenty that I don't say. There's plenty that I don't tweet.
Absolutely. Because you went there. You were always invited back here. Because you went there, I'll just give an example because you asked. Andrew McCabe. The president went after Andrew McCabe for something that his wife ran as a Democrat, and that had nothing to do with the president.
No. The president knew something early that everybody else is now finding out. The president has excellent instincts, and he knew.
But he didn't
Jim
say
Comey
that.
And Andrew
he talked
Cabe,
about his wife.
You don't know that he didn't say that. He knew that Andrew McCabe could not be trusted. And look what happened just this week. Andrew McCabe, it's admitted now that he lied four times, at least three under oath, Dana, criminal referral just this week because he lied about leaking to the media. This is the number two at the FBI. This should have everybody concerned. Everybody should go back and look at what the FBI was doing and not doing while Comey and McCabe were in charge of it. And they all thought, if not wanted, the other person to win the election. And that so colored and politicized so much of their actions and their inactions.
Well, as you know, as you mentioned, the inspector general is asking to look into Andrew McCabe, and we are covering that, and we will continue to cover that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Kellyanne. Appreciate it.
So a longer clip than usual, but we thought it would be really valuable to kind of hear them almost in their entirety.
Yeah, this was really, really crazy. And my initial take was that Kellyanne Conway was taken aback in the beginning. And then in the middle, she started recognizing that this was an opportunity to get on a soapbox and kind of tear down CNN a little bit.
And distract from the original hard questions that she couldn't answer.
Yeah. But now, listening to it a second time, I feel like she was just pissed the whole time. Just absolutely
Kellyanne
pissed
was pissed.
Yeah, Kellyanne was pissed.
My impression was, one, she was definitely surprised. She definitely was angry. I think she was offended, but more than that, she saw this as an opportunity to kind of take the brunt and distract from the Trump questions that have such poor answers. And that she couldn't even, like you said, they were like, who is this source that Trump is tweeting about? And she's like, I don't know. Like, she can't even answer basic questions. And so she takes it as an opportunity to kind of like take the microphone or what's talked about.
How do you feel about Dana Bash and how she conducted herself in this? Not yet about whether this question was appropriate. We'll talk about that in a moment. But just in terms of how she handled it after the question was asked.
I think it took her too long to kind of course correct. I think when she got to Andrew McCabe, like there must have been some producer in her ear like, Andrew McCabe, like bring it back to Andrew McCabe. Because I think that was a really valuable point, but it took a while to get to. Like, I really think the comment that Dana Bash made where she says, I'm sure you hear it too. It's hard to have two adults in a situation like this. And then Conway's like, excuse me, hard for whom? Like, now you're saying what I feel or what I don't or what's hard for our marriage. And I think that was an unfortunate thing for Dana Bash to say because it was so distracting.
Yeah, but like that whole section, the middle of that clip we just played, where she's saying, well, it was actually intended to be lighthearted about the fact that we're all grownups who have different opinions. It didn't feel lighthearted the way that she asked it. And, I'm very much on the side of Conway here. I don't think Bash, first of all, I don't think she necessarily handled it well, although we don't know that it was a producer in her ear about the Andrew McCabe. It could have been she who thought about it. And I think that's a good point that President Trump has used spouses to great effect, like what they say, to disparage them or to call into question where their loyalties lie.
Yeah, and just for context, for Andrew McCabe, Jill McCabe, his wife, was running for office in the Virginia, I think, state assembly, I believe.
As a Democrat.
As a Democrat. And also, Conway herself has kind of mentioned family members, specifically James Comey, the fact that his wife and his daughter supported Clinton. There was kind of like all this talk this week, and she was part of it, like, you know, saying that Comey was biased.
Right. So I think those were really good, legitimate points in this discussion about spouses. But in general, spouses don't answer to each other. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like Kellyanne is not there representing her spouse. She's there representing the president. She doesn't have to defend her spouse. That's kind of like a personal thing. And I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to assume that someone's spouse thinks all the same things and works for the president. Like, he doesn't work for the president. You know, her spouse doesn't work for the president. And the one thing that it reminded me of a lot, where Dana Bash says something like, I can't remember the last time this happened. It's like, there is a prominent CNN commentator named James Carville, who was a top political aide to President Clinton, and his wife was a top Republican political aide. So it's not unprecedented that people have different political opinions and make those opinions known publicly. And I don't quite understand.
But there was no Twitter back then when they were going on. And I think,
yeah, but she was on TV all the time. Watch the documentary, The War Room.
No, I know that, but I don't think it's a fair comparison that Kellyanne and George Conway, who are prominent Republican thought leaders, or even representing the White House. And I disagree. I think it's fair game. I think the fact that I think it would be much different if George Conway was a much more private person and wasn't, you know, did an interview for jobs in the administration. He is front and center, part of the conversation about what's happening in the Republican Party and how people are reacting to the Republican Party and reacting to the Trump White House. And so I think what he says matters. And the fact that he's married to someone who works in the White House also matters.
But why does Kellyanne Conway have to answer for his conduct?
I don't think what her husband says is her fault. Obviously, it's not like he's a grown-ass man. He can say whatever he wants. But I don't think it's an unfounded question to say, like, in what position does that make you? What is going on? How do you respond to both of these men in your life who have very, like, one is your boss, one is your husband, and you're somehow in the middle?
But that's a very personal question for an interview where an aide is just defending the president. Like, would you imagine that question being asked of, like, you know, a PR spokesperson working for Facebook? Like,
she's not just a PR. She's one of the senior advisors to the White House. And what her husband says about the Republican Party, like, influences what they do and the stance they take. Like, I think it's totally valid. I don't think it's like, I just think it's very different.
Yeah, I just very strongly disagree. I think what Dana might have asked that I might have been okay with is, George Conway is a prominent, well-respected lawyer in the Republican Party, and he's recently been tweeting questions about the president's conduct, and that has raised a lot of conversation within the media. Can you tell me how the White House responds to some of his claims?
Yeah, I think, this is kind of my issue with Dana Bash. I think sometimes she phrases things really poorly. I think the content of her question is fair game. But I agree. I think she could have phrased it in a way that invited a more narrowed response. I think she could have said something along the lines of, Kellyanne, your husband, who was up for two different positions in the White House, who, you know, played XY role in, you know, in the investigation, finds that a lot of the things that happened in the White House were distracting, has said, you know, this tweet and that tweet. And, you know, he's not alone. There are Republicans who feel frustrated with the White House. How do you respond both to, like, Republicans more broadly and to, you know, one you know so well?
Or it could just be, do you agree that it's distracting, right? Like, rather than saying, what's up with your husband's tweets, which is exactly what she said. She said those words.
That's what Dana said.
What is up with your husband's tweets?
Exactly.
She could have said, do you agree with this statement? And in fact, it's kind of interesting. This now flashes me back to a moment that I really remember from Tim Russert, where he was interviewing Hillary Clinton at one point. And this was obviously way back when Tim Russert was alive. And he was asking her a tough question. And he said something like, a prominent Democratic commentator, I want to get your reaction to what was said, said this. And then he read this quote. And then she responded to it. And then he said, oh, and that prominent Democratic person was your husband, Bill Clinton. It was like, ooh, man, like, wow. But it wasn't like, you need to answer to this because he's your husband. It was, you need to answer to this because
this person matters. Yeah, and what do you think about it?
This person's voice matters. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting comparison.
So, all in all, what was your take on that whole debacle, that crazy, crazy interview? Was it good? Was it bad? What was it?
It was a mess. It was a total mess. And I think a lot of the crazy, you know, Kellyanne spews nonsense a lot, but unfocused journalism like this makes it so easy for Kellyanne to have these kind of moments. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I really feel like it was, what was asked was inappropriate, the way it was asked, and it was absolutely a mess, and I don't think CNN looked good. I think Kellyanne looked a little like a victim of the whole situation, and it ultimately distracted from the issues that mattered, which is what these shows are supposed to be about.
I agree.
But you couldn't look away.
Just like if you were at that restaurant, you can't not eavesdrop into the fight that's happening in the other table.
People at CNN will be talking.
Oh my goodness. Are you kidding me? They're like, oof.
And the other thing that was crazy was that after this, Dana Bash was not able to throw it to commercial and like get a sip, drink of water, you know, like, she rolled right into the interview with Bob Corker.
It was the right into the interview with Bob Corker. And she had some clumsy mistakes in there, too.
Yeah, particularly in the beginning.
With the North Korea, remember? Yeah. And she, like, said complete, like, denuclearization. He's like, no one's talking about that. She's like, oh, yeah, right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was really flustered.
They should have thrown to commercial. Her producer should have said, we're going to commercial now.
Yeah.
But I think probably Bob Corker had been waiting for a while because this interview wasn't supposed to go this long.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So they needed to not be too late for him. And I could you imagine him sitting there? Because often they're like watching the feed before they go on the interview. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, I don't think he wanted to touch that. He's like, no way. Well, that brings us to show rankings.
What an extraordinary week.
That is an understatement. What is number one in your rankings, Brendan?
Oh, hands down, number one is Face the Nation. We haven't talked too much about it, but we're going to talk about it here in rankings because it was segment after segment after segment of just fantastic, fantastic material. The first thing we're going to mention is that Face the Nation featured a historian by the name of John Dickerson.
It was so great. He was on to talk a little bit about Barbara Bush, which I think was an important conversation to have. All the shows did, but of course, John did a great job. And also, he has a new
article,
not a book.
Yeah.
But an article.
Maybe it'll be a book.
Yeah, of course, it's going to be a book. But a new front cover article in The Atlantic about the presidency, not about this specific president, but the presidency as an office.
Yeah, and taking that kind of historical perspective and saying, you know, where has the presidency gone? What has it become? And is it too much for one person to handle at this point?
But one point of that interview we definitely wanted to highlight was an important question that Margaret Brennan asked John Dickerson, specifically about Trump's absence at Barbara Bush's funeral on Saturday morning. Let's take a listen and that response.
Was it right for President Trump not to attend the funeral?
Well, I think I don't know right or wrong. We certainly know that he attacked the Bush family during the campaign, said that George W. Bush lied the country into the Iraq War, attacked them both specifically and a lot of the things they stood up for. So I think Melania Trump was in keeping with the continuity of a long presidency. But I think you could have gotten into something maybe a little bit more bitter if he had attended. So you don't want to do anything to take away from that extraordinary life and the celebration of it. And so I think it worked out well.
So Margaret Brennan is the only person who mentioned Trump's absence in any way. My theory is that
it was mentioned that Melania was there in Trump's stead.
Right. All the shows mentioned that. But nobody kind of blatantly asked, like, what do you think that Trump didn't go? Part of my theory is I feel like there was an unspoken agreement among media to not really mention that Trump wasn't there. Like, they would wanted the attention to be on First Lady Barbara Bush. But I think Margaret Brennan asked the question in a very, you know, mannerly, classy, respectful way. But to still highlight that, like, hey, our current president was tweeting about what druggy sources during Barbara Bush's funeral.
And that's not the only thing that she mentioned that other hosts this week failed to bring up. For example,
Mark, there was also sort of a battle being played out in the public eye this week within the administration. Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, was on this show, couldn't have been more definitive or clear in the timing and the specific rollout of Russia sanctions. And then the White House said she was confused. What happened and where are the sanctions?
Well, I think what happened here is that some people were ready to throw Nikki Haley under the bus. Larry Kudlow down in Florida during the week said that maybe she was a little bit confused. Other officials suggested she was out of the loop, that there'd been subsequent meetings she wasn't included in. She then answered rather authoritatively, I was not confused. I think that was actually a very interesting blow by a woman in the president's cabinet to stake her ground. And I think it's made a big impression.
Yeah, so I really appreciate that she brought up this story that touches on Russia. It touches on the UN. It touches on the Sunday shows, because, of course, that's where it happened last week. And on Larry Kudlow, who's only been in his new position, which is kind of overseeing all this tariff mess that the White House is doing. He's only been in that position for a few days. So a very important issue that Margaret Brennan was the only one to bring up this week.
Absolutely. And then the last little bit that we wanted to highlight from Face the Nation was an interview that she had with the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif. And that whole, the whole interview is excellent. But there was one point in particular where Minister Zarif really highlights what the United States is walking away from.
But you won't say we in the future we don't intend to build a bomb.
That's very clear. It is in the nuclear agreement.
It's not clear to President Trump, though. This is one of the things he's most concerned about.
That's the sunset clause, specifically. Three lines down the preface to the agreement. It says Iran commits itself never to develop a nuclear weapon. You don't need even to read the entire 150 pages of the deal. Just read the first three lines, and it's there. There is no sunset to the fact that Iran will never seek nuclear weapons.
Yeah, this was very much another instance of somebody who clearly has their area of focus that they're an expert on. This guy is the foreign minister, and then there's President Trump. And Trump is saying something that he really doesn't know what he's talking about. And the Iranian foreign minister has to explain to him that if he had just read the Iranian nuclear agreement that he's really wants to tear up on May 12th. And one of the main reasons President Trump says he wants to tear it up is that there's no guarantee that Iran won't start its nuclear program up as soon as the Iranian deal is expired. The foreign minister says, did you read the thing? You don't even have to read all 150 pages. Read three lines into it, please.
So excellent, excellent show, Face the Nation all around. Margaret Brennan did a great job. And the producers, Mary Hager, they're doing just a great job.
Yeah, fantastic work there. And that is number one. And that's all that matters. Everything else is number four. No.
Number two, what would you say is?
I would say this week.
Okay.
I think George Stephanopoulos had that fascinating panel that we just highlighted for quite a bit in our segments, and everything else was pretty strong.
I would have said number two for Meet the Press, because I thought Chuck Todd did a really good job with White House Legislative Director Mark Short. I thought that interview was really well done, and I thought Chuck Todd had kind of strong follow-up questions. But I do agree that the legal panel on this week was really interesting. So, yeah, I'm okay with that. Number two this week. Number three, Meet the Press.
And number four, State of the Union.
State of the Union so far is like has number four stamped all over it.
And yet there were some, like we mentioned, State of the Union was also a highlight this week. But My goodness,
the low points were so low.
Yeah, it was just fascinating. Fascinating. We thought that our show would be about one thing, and then we got to that interview. We're like, whoa, this episode of Polylog is very different now.
yeah, totally changed the agenda. Well, that's it for Polylog. This week and every week, we encourage you to make your dialogue count.
And this week, we encourage you to wait until you pass judgment on any sort of topic you're discussing, or particularly a person or a situation, because you never know when you're going to get some crazy left-of-field question by Dana Bash that's going to run everything off its rails. Or maybe something will be delightfully insightful.
Good suggestion. You can email us at podcast@polylog.com.
You can follow me at bsteidel on Twitter.
You can follow me at @SotoNaomi_, and you can follow the show at Polylogcast.
Thanks, everyone, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks. Talk soon. Bye.